Meet Reed Lance Rosenthal, rancher, number one best-selling award-winning author, and unabashedly, unapologetically, on the right side of the outstanding issues of our generation. But don't try to fence him in. Sometimes his positions will surprise you, because Reed is definitely his own man, with his own opinions. You might love him, you might hate him, but you won't be able to stop listening. Step over to the right side with Reed.
Happy Saturday or happy Sunday, wherever you may be in this USA or around the globe. This is Reed Lance Rosenthal on the Right Side Radio. Bunch of stuff to cover today, just like we always have, and I'm going to get right to it. We're going to have the second part of our historical story on censorship. Last week, if you missed it, listen to it, www.ontherightsideradio.com. We had our initial segment on censorship. Basically, back thousands of years through all sorts of regimes and empires. And this week, we're going to cover censorship in the United States of America, going all the way back, in fact, to 1798. This is not a new thing, although the way it's being employed, as you will find out during this show, is wholly different. Then we're going to have a really long rat-a-tat-tat. It's actually going to be a rat-a-tat-a-tat-a-tat-a-tat. We're going to catch up on several weeks where I haven't had time to get to it. I'm going to bring you up to speed on what's been going on in the last week. And there's a lot of interconnected dots. You know, danger, Will Robertson, danger, as you will see. Let me pose a question to you. Why would you not trust a government who says that if you say you don't trust the government, you are a terrorist? You could just kind of think about that question until we get to rat-a-tat-tat. If we have time after this extended rat-a-tat-tat session, we're going to get into, because lots of people have been asking, more specific numbers on what hospitals are charging for various levels of COVID treatment, starting with testing, and then if you test positive, and then if you're admitted to the hospital, and then if you go into ICU, and then if you go on a ventilator, and finally, believe it or not, the bonus they get paid if you die in the hospital. Along with bonuses paid for the use of certain drugs which have been discontinued in other treatments. I'm talking about remdesivir, because it has a 50% effect, according to scientists, or adverse effect on your livers, your kidneys, and your heart. We'll get into that. That'll make your eyes pop, let me tell you. And finally, if we have time today, and we're definitely going to do it next week, we're going to talk about some what-ifs. I've discussed in previous shows with you the Democratic Marxist reluctance to give up power. Power which they seized, of course, illegitimately. And there's more and more of that coming out. We're going to talk a little bit about it in the rat-a-tat-tat. You know, election fraud. In fact, there's been several big sentences handed down for voter fraud and election fraud just the last week around the country, including to some BLM, you know, Black Lives Matter, high mucky mucks. There is a number of things that Democratic Marxists can do to try and affect the 2022 elections. They absolutely know their policies stink. They absolutely know that the vast majority of the country wants nothing to do with most of the stuff they're trying to get done. They don't care. That's not what they're about. They are not for the people, of the people, or by the people. They are for themselves in every respect, in terms of control, in terms of power, and in terms of financial gain. And they think, I'll be kind. They don't think kindly of anybody who gets in their way or anybody who voices opposition or a dissident opinion. Just take a look at what's happened with world-renowned scientists related to COVID and the jab. Of course, that's now all falling apart, too. We're going to cover that in the rat-a-tat-tat. And it's falling apart not because the science has changed, as suddenly all the Democrats and their media mouthpieces are beginning to clamor in unison using the same words over the last week, but because those policies don't work. And because 70% of Americans, based on a poll just in the last week, said they're done with this. And that's not going to help them for the 2022 midterms, particularly since their election fraud bills are stalled in the Senate and the House, and they're getting a number of court rulings not going in their way on their continued attempts to try and take emergency measures, which should have never been implemented, that were implemented in 2020. quite intentionally, of course. So we'll be talking about that too. But there's some things, there's some eye-popping things that the Democrats could try and pull off, including Nancy Pelosi as president. Think about that terrorizing prospect. All right, let's get started. The right to free speech, you know, it's a long-standing tradition in these United States. It was a long-standing tradition, and now our Democratic Marxist friends, the cabal, are trying to take all those COVID-related worthless, needless, and intentional emergency voting measures and make them permanent. Unfortunately, there's this document called the United States Constitution, Article 2.2.A to be exact, which stands in their way. Only state legislatures can do that. But we'll talk about some of those cases which have come and gone and not to the delight of Democratic Marxists here over the last week or two. One of the things we're going to discuss, if we have time at the end of this show, and certainly next week, is some of the eye-popping things these folks can do to try and screw with you, screw with your vote, and screw with the outcome of the 2022 elections. And it's a wide range of things. I'll give you one example. Think about Nancy Pelosi as president of the United States. How's that for a terrorizing prospect? It's a possibility. I wouldn't put it past them. But we'll get to that hopefully today, and if not, we will get to it in depth next week. It'll be some things for you to puzzle and ponder. Before I get into the historical story, I want to send a hats off to the truckers up there in Canada. Now, Trudy, as I call him, I think that's kind of a perfect name, Trudy is being adamant that he won't release the restriction and he won't dampen down his outrageous COVID mandates. It doesn't matter that John Hopkins and a bunch of other studies that went over with you last week have come out and said that lockdowns and all those standards, masks, the whole things, the mandates, are absolutely counterproductive, cause far more injury and death than they might and probably do not save. Never mind that all of a sudden, just because it's the 2022 elections, all the Democrats here in the United States, they're jumping up and down saying, oh, the science has changed. We need to take the masks off. We need to relax the restrictions. Yeah, well, I think that's polling, folks. I don't think it has anything to do with their relinquishment of control. And by the way, if you think for 1 minute that if these people get back in office, they won't slap these lockdowns or other Nazi-like impositions on the American people, for any reason whatsoever, any reason they can conjure, whether it's the next variant of COVID, or whether it's some new disease, or whether it's, as we're going to talk about in the rat-a-tat-tat, some kind of false flag related to supposed and conjured domestic terrorism, which includes, as you're going to see, anybody who says they don't trust the United States government. I'm not making this up. Wait till I read this to you. From the DHS, no less. But I want to take my hat off to the Canadian truckers and the Canadian people. That was an incredible display over the last 10 days, and it's ongoing. We shall see how it all turns out. But basically, they have border checkpoints blocked all along the U.S.-Canadian border. They have brought Ottawa to a standstill, and they are holding on to their positions. You know, the mayor of Ottawa, who is nothing more than a Trudy and globalist lackey, has jumped through hoops. He's directly interfered, and hopefully he'll get sued, with their GoFundMe, $10 million. GoFundMe was going to take the money, you probably know this, and give it to the charities, basically, of their choice. I mean, you know, outright theft. But that's what happens if you deal with GoFundMe. How about we don't do that anymore? Instead, they have a great new fundraising mechanism, which is, I believe, Give, Send, Go. Whatever it is posted right under the audio bar on the OnTheRightSideRadio.com site. If you have not given, I suggest you do. By the way, did you know that Trudy and his ministers actually came out? It's on our Facebook site, www.facebook.com/OnTheRightSideRadio. Actually, it's facebook.com/OnTheRightSideRadio. You really need to watch this video of one of the high mucky muck globalist ministers and kowtowers to Trudy telling Americans that if they give to the truckers, the Canadian secret police are very powerful and they're all knowing and will track you down and will prosecute you for undermining national security. I mean, does that give you an idea of how a globalist thinks? Does that give you any inkling as to what disdain they hold us and their own people, the Canadians, in? Does that give you any inkling of what they think of your rights to express your opinions, whether it's by donation or whether it's by letter or whether it's by speech or whether it's by gathering or protest? In the United States, we have the Constitution, which is under constant attack. In Canada, they have the 1986 Charter of Rights, which allows peaceful assembly to redress differences with the government. I mean, this is the playbook of the globalists and democratic Marxists in concert with the globalist cabal, you know, the Davos crowd, and the economic giants Vanguard and BlackRock. I've talked about them in the Robber Baron series. Combined with communist China is phenomenal. Their arrogance is unbelievable. Their disregard for rights, liberty, and the individual is shocking. And this is just one representative sample. What the truckers up there in Canada don't know is that they have fueled a worldwide revelation. And that is, and it's happening in Italy, and it's happening in Australia, and it's happening in Austria, it's happening across the globe. Convoys of trucks blocking this and blocking that. But more than that, they've sent a message to the United States. And the United States, all of a sudden, the Democratic Marxists are real interested in polling how people feel about what's happening in Canada and how people feel about COVID mandates and restrictions overall. And evidently, that polling is really not good for them. I mean, really not good for them. Because just in the last week, we hear this choir of the same straight Democratic voices that have been talking about throwing, literally, I've brought you the articles, I've brought you the stories, throwing the unvaccinated in concentration camps, executing the unvaccinated, making the unvaccinated secondary citizens, throwing people in jail for not wearing masks. I can go on down the list. These same people, as we're going to get into in the rat-a-tat-tat, are now jumping up and down saying, the science has changed, the science has changed. You know, the sky is falling, the sky is falling. So these chicken littles are now saying that all mandates and all restrictions should be dropped immediately because the science has changed. Yeah, no. It's because they're underwater on the upcoming election and they can't figure out a way to fraud their way into office. All right. Anyway, hats off to the Canadians. Hats off to the Canadian truckers. I don't know if you know, but there is a big American convoy gearing up, and it may have to do with some of this DH warnings about domestic terrorism that I'm going to go over with you in rat-a-tat-tat. And they're shooting for March 1. I'm sure we'll hear lots more about it. We shall see. I will be very disappointed if the American convoy is not twice the 50,000, give or take, truck Canadian convoy. Very disappointed. And the American truckers deserve our support then, upcoming, just as the Canadian truckers deserve our support now. They're out there fighting for your freedoms, and they're making a difference around the world, even if Trudeau is not giving in to them in Canada. There are provincial prime ministers who, however, are caving to their demands to end all mandates and restrictions. A lesson can be learned. You know, the Canadians are rather docile, peace-loving folks. I mean, they're pretty much nice people. And for them to get this riled up, and for millions of them, far more than the 3.5%, remember our series on the fall of civilizations, far more than the 3.5% necessary to effect a change in government. Getting that many people riled up in typically docile Canada, you have to work at that. And in typical Democratic Marxist fashion, you know, they hate history, so they have not learned anything from history. The more you clamp down, the more active the resistance becomes. People are not going to go quietly, particularly in North America and to a certain extent in certain countries in Europe. They're not going to go quietly into the night. Not going to happen. Just the opposite is going to happen. And it's happening. It's happening around the world. And it's happening in our northern neighbor and we need to support it. Because their fight is our fight. Our fight is the same as the Italians and the Spanish and the British, who, by the way, Boris Johnson just kicked out all mandates in Britain. No more mandates on anything, period. So you can see what an effect this is having the world over. Good for the Canadians. Go Canada. Let's get into our historical story. So last week, we went over kind of censorship through the ages. All sorts of locations and places and countries and regimes and empires going back thousands of years. This week, we're going to go over American censorship. You know, the right to free speech, obviously, is a long-standing tradition in these United States. However, folks, I think you'll agree that respecting the right to free speech is not a long-standing tradition. The American Civil Liberties Union, the ACLU, you know, I'm not a big fan of them, but they define censorship as, quote, the suppression of words, images, or ideas that are, quote unquote, offensive. And it happens whenever some people succeed in imposing their personal, political, or moral values on others, unquote. And the ACLU goes on to say that freedom of expression may only be limited, quote, if it will clearly cause direct and imminent harm to an important societal interest, unquote, period. Well, you know, even that is subjective. So I tend to part companies on their definition at that point. Let's go to 1798. John Adams, you know, he gets revenge on all his critics, and boy, did he have a lot of critics. There was a supporter of challenger Thomas Jefferson, you know, Tom Jefferson, and this was during the election back there in the late 1700s, who called Adams, quote, old, querulous, bald, blind, crippled, and toothless, unquote. Adams didn't like that much. By the way, this was not the only, shall we say, detrimental thought being hurled in his direction. So he signed a bill in 1798 that made it illegal to criticize a government official unless you could back one's criticisms in court. This, by the way, evolved into our current libel laws. I've gone over those with you in my Supreme Court historical series, what, 8-10 weeks ago. Well, 25 people were arrested under this law. Jefferson, who won the election, pardoned all the victims of the law after he defeated Adams in the 1800 election. Later sedition acts, and we're going to get into this in the rat-a-tat-tat, focused primarily on punishing those who advocated civil disobedience. Not violence now, civil disobedience. The Sedition Act of 1918 was put into effect ostensibly to target draft resistors, but in typical government fashion, it did far more than that. Then let's go to 1821. This is the longest ban, the longest piece of censorship in U.S. history. There was a novel. It was called Fanny Hill, for obvious reasons that I'm about to explain. 1748. It was written by an author by the name of John Cleland, C-L-E-L-A-N-D. And it was based on what he imagined a prostitute's memoirs might sound like. Which, by the way, we all love Benjamin Franklin, but Benji wrote himself some pretty risque material, and he had a copy of this particular book. The book holds the record for being banned longer than any other literary work in the United States. It was prohibited in 1821, and it was not legally published, although there were many counterfeit, there were black market copies out there, until the Supreme Court overturned the ban in a case called Memoirs versus Massachusetts in 1966. Think about that. Of course, you know, once it became legal, it didn't have quite the same appeal. But by 1996 standards, I think you'll agree, and particularly by today's standards, nothing written in 1748 was liable to shock anyone. 1873, okay, there's this mad censor, as he was known. His name was Anthony Comstock. He was in, of course, New York. And he is a clear-cut villain in the history of U.S. censorship. So in 1872, feminist, her name was Victoria Woodhull, she published an account of an affair between a celebrity evangelical minister and one of his parishioners. I guess it was kind of a, you know, mockingbird thing or something. Comstock, who, by the way, despised feminists, requested a copy of a book under a fake name, and then he reported Woodhull and had her arrested on obscenity charges. I can't make this up. This is in the United States of America. He soon became head, by the way, of the New York Society for the Suppression of Vice. Oh, well, wow. Woo. And he successfully campaigned, believe it or not, for an 1873 federal obscenity law, which was called the Comstock Act. You probably heard of it. And it allowed warrantless searches, this is in the United States of America, of the mail for obscene materials. Of course, obscene is in the eye of beholder, as is about everything. Comstock, by the way, boasted that during his career as a censor, his work led to the suicides of 15 alleged, as he called them, smut peddlers. So, you know, Comstock would have, I think, been having a heyday in current times. 1921, the Odyssey of Joyce's book, Ulysses. So the New York Society for the Suppression of Vice, you know, our buddy Comstock, blocked the publication of Irish writer James Joyce's Ulysses in 1921. And they cited this rather tame masturbation scene as proof of obscenity. U.S. publication was finally permitted in 1933, following a United States District Court ruling. By the way, the case was United States versus one book called Ulysses. And the judge, John Woolsey, found that the book was not obscene and essentially established artistic merit as an affirmative defense against obscenity charges. Now, that's a two-edged sword, right? But nonetheless, that's what happened on this evolution of censorship in America. 1930, the Hays Code. All right, well, you know, the Hays Code was never really enforced by the government, but just the existence of the code, which kind of ties into what the Democratic Marxists are trying today. You know, just the existence of an edict by unelected officials that has not gone through the legislature is supposed to frighten and chill the speech of dissenters. And in this case, there was a code. And the film industry and film distributors were so nervous about the threat of government censorship, they kind of came up with their own code. There was a case that preceded this. It was called Mutual Film Corporation versus Industrial Commission of Ohio. It was a 1915 case. The movies were not, this is the ruling, the movies that were being litigated were not protected by the First Amendment, and foreign films could be seized on obscenity charges. It was subsequent to that that the Hays Code was passed, and subsequent to that that the film industry adopted the Hays Code, which was never enforced, as a means of avoiding outright federal censorship. The Hays Code, by the way, regulated the movie industry in Hollywood from 1930 until 1968, and it banned violence, sex, and profanity. It also prohibited, this will open your eyes, portrayals of interracial or same-sex relationships, as well as any content that was deemed anti-religious or anti-Christian. Roth versus U.S., this is a 1957 case. That case confirmed that obscenity was not constitutionally protected. So then, you get into a battle in the censorship realm of the universe as to what is obscenity. Do you see what a rabbit hole censorship becomes? In 1954, comic books, believe it or not, comic books, the Goody Two-Shoes decided that comic books should be kid-friendly and bland. Now, you know, you would think that parents could control comic books that their kids are reading, but no, the government had to step in. And it was called the Comics Code, and it was administered by the Comics Code Authority, the CCA, an acronym. And it became, once again, a voluntary industry standard, kind of like the Hays deal with film. The CCA is less dangerous than the film counterpart, the Hays Code, and it's still kind of in use, believe it or not, today. Though, let's face it, if you've read comic books lately, most comic book publishers are ignoring it and no longer even submit material for CCA approval. The driving force behind CCA was the fear that violent, dirty, or otherwise questionable, like in Whose Mind, comics might turn children into juvenile delinquents. Yeah, not that the current education system can't do that, folks. Oh, yeah. And the central thesis of Frederick Wertham's, I don't know if any of you have ever read him, good writer, 1954 bestseller. It was called The Seduction of the Innocent, which argued, although not very credibly, that the Batman-Robin relationship might turn children gay. Not making this up. This is the history of censorship in the United States. You know, sometimes history is stranger than truth. How about Lady Chatterley's moratorium? Okay, so there's a senator. His name is Reed Schmoot, S-M-00-T. And although he admitted that he had never read D.H. Lawrence's Lady Chatterley's Lover, which was published in 1928, he called it, remember, he's never read it, and he admitted it. He called it most damnable. This is a 1930 speech. And quote, "It is written by a man with a diseased mind and a soul so black that he would obscure even the darkness of hell," unquote. This is a guy who never read the book, folks. Okay. Anyway, Lawrence's story, by the way, was about an affair between a gal by the name of Constance Chatterley and her husband's servant. And, you know, at the time, non-tragic portrayals of adultery, which is really what this was, were pretty much non-existent. The Hays Code had banned them from film, and federal censors had banned all that stuff from print media. In 1959, there was a federal obscenity trial, and the ban on the book was lifted. By the way, that book is now regarded as a classic piece of literature. Ah, my, how times do turn. 1971, the New York Times. You've heard of the Pentagon Papers. Many of you may remember that huge brouhaha. But there was a military study, and it was titled United States-Vietnam Relations, 1945-1967, a study prepared by the Department of Defense, unquote. That later became known as the Pentagon Papers. It was supposed to be classified, but whistleblowers leaked parts of the document to the New York Times in 1971, and all hell broke loose. President Richard Nixon threatened to have journalists indicted for treason. Federal prosecutors attempted to block further publication. And the reason was, why was the government so concerned about this, folks? You know, the government that you're supposed to trust, according to this week's edicts from the DHS, as we're going to get into. Because the documents revealed that U.S. leaders had, amongst other things, specifically taken measures to prolong and escalate what was a very unpopular war. Why don't you think Ukraine, Russia, NATO, America, like right now as I'm speaking to you? Obscenity. Obscenity finally gets kind of defined in 1973 because a lot of this censorship was based on the subjective notion of what is or what is not obscenity. There was a 5-4 ruling by the Supreme Court. The majority was led by Chief Justice Warren Burger. I've mentioned him many times in my series on the Supreme Court, the history of the Supreme Court. And the case was called Miller versus California. And it was about a mail order porn case, really. And this was the ruling. This is just part of the ruling. Quote, "The average person must find that the work, taken as a whole, appeals to the prurient interest. The work depicts or describes in a patently offensive way sexual conduct or excretory functions specifically defined by applicable state law, and the work, taken as a whole, lacks serious literary, artistic, political, or scientific value," unquote. The Supreme Court, by the way, also held in 1987 that the First Amendment does not protect obscenity. And it was based, by the way, that ruling was based on this definition of obscenity by the Supreme Court of 1973. 1978, the indecency standard. I mean, if you can't get them on obscenity, let's go for indecency. George Carlin's Seven Dirty Words, that was the name of his routine, which was aired on a New York radio station in 1973. One father, listening to the station, complained to the FCC, the Federal Communications Commission. The FCC, being the good government watchdog that it is, wrote the station a letter of reprimand. But the station said, no, sorry, will not comply. And it ultimately went to the Supreme Court, and there was a landmark decision, FCC versus Pacifica, it's 1978. And the court held that the material that is indecent, I'm quoting now, indecent but not necessarily obscene, may be regulated by the FCC if it is distributed through publicly owned wavelengths. And the FCC defines indecency, folks, as, quote, "language or material that in context depicts or describes in terms patently offensive as measured by contemporary community standards for the broadcast medium, sexual or excretory organs or activities," unquote. So, I want you to keep all this in mind as we go through the stories in Rat-a-tat-tat, which is upcoming, about what's happening with censorship today, right now, last week, here in the United States. We've already reviewed in general form what's going on in Canada at the beginning of the show. So, in 1996, this was all codified. It was codified in the Communications Decency Act of 1996. And that act mandated a federal prison sentence of up to 2 years for anyone who knowingly, let me quote, quote, uses any interactive computer service to display in a manner available to a person under 18 years of age any comment, request, suggestion, proposal, image, or other communication that in context depicts or describes in terms patently offensive as measured by contemporary community standards, sexual or excretory activities or organs. That bill, by the way, was strengthened by a later bill called the Child Online Protection Act, or COPA, C-O-P-A, which was 1998, which additionally criminalized any content that was deemed harmful to minors. Courts immediately blocked COPA, by the way. And finally, the COPA part of this kind of two-fisted punch on censorship was struck down in 2009. Now, listen, I'm giving you history here. You may agree or disagree with where these courts have held. You can see the same threads and words that weave through 100 years of jurisprudence here. Once again, you know, the setting of legal precedent, which we talked about in the Supreme Court series. If you didn't listen to it, you should. It's kind of fascinating. On the RightSideRadio.com. In 2004, okay, the FCC had kind of a meltdown, okay? You probably remember this. Remember Janet Jackson's right breast became slightly exposed? There was a big brouhaha, and, you know, some people said, oh, it was on purpose, and other people, yeah, whatever. I'm not here to opine on what happened to her wardrobe malfunction, if that's what it was. But the FCC swung into action, and there was an organized campaign about this indecency of Janet Jackson. And the FCC began to enforce these indecency standards more aggressively than it had ever before. Pretty soon, for a while, every expletive uttered at an award show or any bit of nudity, even if it was pixelated on reality television, and every other potentially offensive act became a possible target of the FCC. Obviously, that it seems to be no longer the case today. We come to 2017, online censorship. And boy, you know, I could do a series of shows over what happened in 2020 and over what is happening today. When the Supreme Court struck down the Communications Decency Act, and the case was Reno versus ACLU in 1997, it was a huge victory for free speech rights. It was a glorious upholding of the First Amendment regarding cyberspace. But the ACLU notes that 13 states have passed online censorship legislation since 1995. Several have been struck down by cases brought by the ACLU. Once again, I'm no fan of the ACLU. They have strayed far from their original righteous path, unfortunately. So many state censorship laws violate the First Amendment, folks. You know, you not only get censorship at the federal level, you get it at the state levels. We're going to talk about that in rat-a-tat-tat in just a moment. Wait till you hear what Washington State is doing. Wait till you hear what New York State is doing. And wait till you hear what the federal government is doing. And this is all in the last week because of 2022 elections. You know, you got to damp down that campaign rhetoric, folks. Anyway, there's a media watchdog review. It's called the Columbia Journalism Review. And let me give you a quote from that. Quote, new technologies make it more difficult and ultimately impossible for governments to control the flow of information. Some have argued that the birth of the internet foreshadowed the death of censorship. But that isn't the case. And censorship is being used by the government in an intimidating manner against social media, print media, and in the flow of online information. Unquote. And it's even worse than that, folks. Because now we have example after example after example of these big social media and big tech companies working hand in hand with the United States government, with the Chinese government, with the Canadian government, and on ad infinitum, to censor, to distort, to interfere with, and the worst censorship of all, to omit dissident opinions, thought, and the transmission of those opinions from one person to another. And I think that is the perfect lead-in to rat-a-tat-a-tat-a-tat-tat, which is the rat-a-tat-tat of today's show. A couple of things really quick here before we get into a rat-a-tat-a-tat-a-tat which is what we have going today. Thanks to all of you who have been visiting the On the Right Side Radio Facebook page, www.facebook.com/OnTheRightSideRadio. We have been posting piles of stuff this week, a lot on the Canadian trucking situation, the Trudeau's minister threatening Americans who are giving to the Canadian truckers. Wow. That's all you can say is wow. And some great memes and stuff which will make you laugh. And throw a like at the page. There's been a bunch of likes thrown at it. Really appreciate that. Again, if you want to contact me or On the Right Side, ontherightsideradio@reagan.com. R-E-A-G-A-N, the president's name. ontherightsideradio@reagan.com. We love comments. Please do contact us. And last but not least, there's going to be videos underneath the audio bar on the ontherightsideradio.com site. Some are from last week, and we're carrying them over. Others are from this week, including an excerpt I'm going to be playing for you from another Dell Bigtree conversation. This is about the corruption of money when it comes to COVID policies in school. You'll see how the federal government is in there, their little fingers again, just like they are in the hospitals through the American Care Act, which we discussed last week. Folks, the rat-a-tat-tat I'm about to go over with you ties right into the historical story I gave you last week and this week on censorship around the world over thousands of years and here in the United States. In the face of what this government is trying to do, and it will shock you, some of these rat-a-tat-tat stories will shock you, and they are this week, more than ever, you need to stand. You need to look in the mirror. You need to sit with your family. And once a day, you need to repeat, I will muster. I will stand. I will not comply. I will never give in. I will never stop fighting. I will join with those in these United States and across the globe who love freedom as I do, and we will win. Those words are important. Think about those truckers up there in Canada facing the full force and brunt of the Canadian municipal and provincial governments and not backing down one inch. Good for them. They're carrying the fight of the planet on their shoulders right now, hopefully soon joined by American truckers and Americans. Okay, rat-a-tat-tat. Let's start with the perfect lead-in after our historical series on censorship. The Washington Post has reported this week that the Justice Department has formed a new domestic terrorism unit. This was actually 2 weeks ago, excuse me. And this new domestic terrorism unit, you know, this is all planned, folks. Do you understand? None of what I'm about to tell you is a coincidence. These are all dots. They are all connected. They are all part of a plan. They are all about power and control. So they formed this domestic terrorism unit to combat a threat, quote, which has intensified dramatically in recent years. This is Matthew G. Olson, by the way, the head of the Justice Department's National Security Division. And he announced the creation of the unit at the Senate Judiciary Committee. And basically what he said was that the Justice Department had previously had counterterrorism attorneys who worked both domestic and international cases, but the new unit would, quote, augment our existing approach, unquote. Now, immediately following that, we have a speech by President Kadhafi, which I'm sure was written by real President Obama. And basically he said the Constitution is a living document. You know, it doesn't really say what it means. It doesn't really mean what it says. And it needs to be kind of fluid and adjusted to contemporary times and events. Well, folks, no. The originalist concept, i.e. the conservative majority on the Supreme Court, is that the Constitution means exactly what it says and that it is inviolate. Those words are those words. You don't like it? There's several methods to amend it. They are obviously arduous and painstaking. But it has long been a plan and an MO of the left to use lawfare, you know, the courts, to get what they can't get legislatively and what they can't get through the Supreme Court. And the Constitution, contrary to President Kadhafi's mumblings over the past week, is not a fluid document. It is the document from which all laws, the enforcement of all laws, and the creation of all laws flow. And laws are created as is stated in the Constitution. They have to be voted on by the people's representatives, either in a city or in a state or in a county or, yes, even at the federal level. Although Democratic Marxists hate that. They just hate that because they can't get anything passed. And the vitriol which they direct at anybody who dares stand in their way, who dares utter any diversion from their mantra, from their doctrine, including their own people. See what's been happening with Manchin and Sinema. See how the jackals and wolves of the Democratic Marxists have descended on two Democratic senators representing the wishes of their constituents. Democratic Marxists don't care about the wishes of constituents or the wishes of the American people or the majority. They are the tyranny of the minority. So this new task force is formed a couple weeks ago, okay? And they blamed it all on the January 6th riot at the Capitol. That's become a really, really big deal to the Democrats. Nothing else they're doing is working. So let's shift all the focus to January 6th and what drags these conservatives and Republicans and anybody who doesn't toe the Democratic Marxist line are. Yeah, okay. Well, Washington State this week has introduced a bill that would make it illegal to complain or ask any questions about election fraud. I'm really not making this up. Free speech? Free speech, you say? What's free speech? Not in Washington. The CCP of Washington. You know, this is the opposite of transparency. This is the opposite of what you do if you want somebody to have faith in the integrity of elections. You know, we're going to get more into this in the rat-a-tat-tats, but I want to give you kind of all these dots at once, and then we can go into some detail, because they're all connected. They're all connected. You know, the other thing that happened here in the last week or so was that the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms and Explosives, the AFT, they got a letter from 51 Republican legislators, federal legislators, saying, we understand that you're keeping records of gun purchases, which is illegal. I mean, that is in effect an under-the-table registry, which is illegal, of firearms in the United States. I've warned you folks about this in the past. And believe it or not, and by the way, the letter was authored by Representative Michael Cloud, Republican in Texas. Good for you, Michael. And what's amazing is that the ATF acting director, his name is Marvin Richardson, you know, anti-gun guy, he's just who Obama and Cadaver would love. He is keeping the records, he admitted, of 54.7 million firearm sales, and he has been through the entirety of 2021. In fact, in his letter to Congress, he advised them that the ATF currently maintains 920,664,765 out-of-business records, or what's called OBR, of firearm purchases. I want you to think about this. So on one hand, you have Washington State saying it's illegal to question election fraud. On the other hand, you have the DOJ doing their little special anti-American, quote-unquote, squad up there, the domestic terrorism squad, which includes, of course, parents speaking at school boards. And now you have the ATF admitting that it is illegally, I mean, who cares? It's illegal. You know, the Constitution is a living, breathing document. 920 million firearms records. Look, all of this is connected. It's all connected. Let me tell you more about the Washington State deal. And there's more that has happened this week. This is just one thing. So Washington State basically has moved to criminalize any questions concerning election fraud. Does this include the liberals who screamed in 2016 that Trump stole the election from Hillary? Or what Hillary said 2 weeks ago, which is election fraud. There's no election fraud. That's a fallacy of the right. Literally, that's what she said. You know, okay. Let me tell you about, and this comes out of PJ Media, by the way. Candidates and elected officials complaining about election fraud. Remember, this is candidates and elected officials would be slapped with a gross misdemeanor charge, a fine, and or a jail sentence. And this plan was put together by, you know, Washington's, like, ultra-far left governor, Jay Inslee. And it's completely an anti-free speech censorship bill. That's what it is. It's now advanced, believe it or not, from a Democrat-controlled, well, they all are there, controlled committee with a do-pass recommendation. In 2020, governors and all their underlings and the state legislatures, to their discredit, allowed them to do so, used COVID-19 as the excuse to change election laws. I mean, we're all familiar with this. Using emergency powers without legislation, expanding mail-in balloting, removing voter ID, removing signature matching, all sorts of things. I mean, you're familiar with that. There's been a court ruling in the last week, by the way, which kind of set back a lot of that stuff on its heels, but I'll get to that in just a moment. And then, of course, we had Zuckerberg, oh yeah, big tech, censor king, using his $450 million of Zuck election fraud bucks to buy drop boxes and pay campaign, pay poll watchers, etc. In, the seven states that are contested from the 2020 election. So in Inslee's bill up there in Washington State, basically what he's saying, that complaining about election fraud that the accused complainers knew was bogus, if it's adjudged by a jury, according to the governor, could lead to violence. Oh, do you remember the historical story? The words decency, the words obscenity, how they are in the eye of the beholder, how they've been partially defined by the various courts in the Supreme Court. Well, now we get to see who's going to define the word violence, who's going to define the word jury, who's going to define the word election fraud, who's going to define the word complaining, or words complaining about election fraud. Anyway, Inslee says that anybody who utters these words, you know, complaining about or questioning election, should go to jail. Yeah. By the way, this is the same governor, of course, who never said anything in response to the Antifa and BLM riots, which racked his state and around the country in 2016 and 2017, which were designed to depose the democratically then elected Donald Trump. My, how the worm turns. So this measure originally looked like it was dead in the water because it's absurd. I mean, it's the sheer absurdity, even to the minds of Democratic Marxists in Washington State, kind of rendered it impotent. But there was a Washington Post article. Oh, the Washington Post is owned by Jeff Bezos, one of the Davos crowd, one of the shareholders in Vanguard, you know, BlackRock, etc. You see how it's all connected? And they did a big article which alerted kind of the East Coast alt-left political class. Inslee's totally unconstitutional bill. And guess what? Lawrence Tribe, you've heard his name, from, you know, his professor emeritus from Harvard Law School, Harvard, and George Washington University's law school's Catherine Ross. They called Inslee to see if they could rehabilitate this wonderful Senate Bill 5843. Wow. Unbelievable. So Inslee tells lawmakers up there that this bill will cease things which can lead to lawless action. Ooh. And Newsweek reported a few weeks ago that the state Senate up there approved a bill that would make it a felony, punishable by up to 5 years in prison to harass election workers, and cited, you know, manufactured increases in threats and violence against election workers. I mean, really? You know, this is like manufacturing COVID deaths, COVID cases, the J6 nonsense, the Nazi flags, as Trudy calls them up there in the Canada trucker convoy, which don't exist. You got to understand, these folks will say and do anything. They will say and do anything. So Inslee now says that the bill that's being discussed in the Senate Government and Elections Committee, which was January 28th, 2022, by the way, quote, confronts an unrelenting threat that is a clear and present danger in our society, unquote. That's a quote, by the way, right out of the Associated Press. And it would be a gross misdemeanor for any officials or any candidates or any elected people if they are convicted of, I quote, knowingly, recklessly, or maliciously making false statements regarding the election process or election results to produce lawless action, undermine election processes or results, or falsely claim entitlement to public office, unquote. And if you get nailed with this by Mr. Inslee up there, you have to vacate your office, you know, that you got elected to, and then you'd have your penalties, you know, 1 year in prison and a $5,000 fine. I mean, you really can't make this up. You really can't make this up. And there's more along these lines, folks. There's more along these lines, unfortunately. It kind of brings us to election fraud. So a Pennsylvania court in the past week has struck down a portion of the nonsense that the Pennsylvania Secretary of State pushed up there in 2020, you know, because of the COVID thing. Yeah. And that was that you could vote absentee without any excuse. It was called a no-excuse absentee ballot, which, well, of course, resulted in who knows how many fraudulent ballots. A Pennsylvania court has struck that down, saying it's unconstitutional. There can be no excuse absentee ballots in Pennsylvania. The Pennsylvania Democrats and the Democrats nationally are in a panic. I mean, not only are they not getting their election theft bill rammed through the federal government, now they're getting undermined at every level by state governments. Wisconsin made to certify the electors. Arizona has introduced a bill to decertify the 2020 electors. Georgia, I'm not sure it's going to happen, but boy, there's still a brouhaha going on over Fulton County. And I can go on and on. So it's being reversed, and Republican legislators are finally standing up in all these states. Although, listen, the fraud of 2020 occurred under their noses. They did not assert their constitutional authority, rights, or power. And the Democratic Secretary of State, or in the case of Georgia, the Rhino, Raffensperger, Secretary of State, put all this stuff in. The legislature didn't say squat. And, you know, we had the election of 2020. It's unbelievable. And then where we do have election fraud protections and 4,000 people on the ground making sure no fraud occurred in Virginia, we get finally a Republican governor elected who keeps his promises. Okay, here's another rat-a-tat-tat for you. So Governor Youngkin signed a series of 11 executive orders the day he took office. That was January 20th, just 3 weeks ago. And one of those was he repealed his predecessor's mandatory school mask mandate. And then a group of woke parents from the Chesapeake area, they filed a lawsuit against the court to block the order. I guess they liked their kids running around in masks. I don't know. And they were citing the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention guidance. Oh, well, that's worked out really well the last 2 years. In relation to mask wearing in schools, last Monday, the Virginia Supreme Court dismissed the parents' challenge. So Youngkin's order stands. Yay. In Virginia, yeah, and this brings us to the schools. And I'm going to play you an excerpt from a Del Bigtree interview on how the federal government is trying to influence schools, once again, using these CDC and NIH guidelines, with money. Just like they're doing with the hospitals, where they prevent therapeutic treatments which have been proven to work, and instead insist and give the hospitals bonuses, as we're going to discuss, to use therapeutic remedies that do not work. In fact, they kill you. In fact, they're drugs that no other country in the world allows to be used, and they're drugs that have been taken out of the market in 2018 because of their disastrous adverse effects on 50% of the people who got the drug, remdesivir. So in Virginia, education and critical race theory, those were critical issues. It's one of the things that got Youngkin elected, not to mention 4,000 people on the ground and involved, just like you need to be in the upcoming 2022 elections in your area, making sure there was no fraud, making sure there were no machines hooked up to the internet, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So Republicans, all the way from the governor in Virginia, down the ballot to school boards, got in. Hundreds of school board elections and recalls occurred everywhere across the country. Okay, liberals now say, I'm using the term liberals lightly, that the conservative victories will have, quote, a chilling impact on school boards, unquote. Oh, well, gee, that breaks my heart. And the left, always into lawfare, always into finding an end around, you know, kind of like a virus that mutates. They're pushing back at these new conservative policies to end masking, to overhaul policies that relate to diversity, equity, inclusion, and to implement the implementation of policies that are conducive to what school is for, learning reading, writing, math, science, history, and civics. In Denver, Thursday, February 3rd, just a week ago, teachers, you know, I've told you about how far left the teachers' unions are. and by what huge majorities leftists, admitted Marxists in the case of L.A., get elected as president of these teachers' unions. So that tells you where the majority, not all, but the majority of teachers' minds are at. So Thursday, February 3rd, Denver, teachers organized a protest against these new conservative school boards, and they organized a sick out. Well, the result was it forced classes to cancel in Denver. I mean, what did that solve? Who did that benefit? The teachers collected 22,000 signatures. Remember, this is a city of a couple million folks, to recall the conservative board members that had just been elected. And they were elected to reverse woke and pandemic policies. I mean, once again, the lesson here is the left will do anything. They will employ any methodology it takes to maintain and control and manipulate power in perpetuity. In Chicago, a judge issued a temporary restraining order against Illinois Democratic Governor J.B. Pritzker, boy, he's a piece of work, school mask mandate. A school in Chicago rebelled against the court, and they told students that they still had to wear masks, regardless of the judge's ruling. You know, that fluid constitution concept of cadaver. So a group of high school kids, you know, like the Canadian truckers, they took matters into their own hands, and they just walked out of class on Monday, February 7th, and school had to shut down. I love it. In San Francisco, voters are going to be voting on a recall of three far left, like you can't even see them, they're so far left, school board members. And they're accused by parents of extending school closures, enacting racial bias against Asian Americans, pursuing relentless social justice agendas, and sacrificing a true quality education. So that is coming up, and I'm going to follow it for you and for all you parents and grandparents out there. Okay, look, the truth about education in America, folks, is that people like Inslee want a class of children that will look at the law he's proposing in Washington, which is straight Orwellian censorship, and support it. That's the battle at the school level. One of the things that the left has been using to get parents under control and students under control are these COVID mandates as it relates to school, you know, and it's been cheered and championed and pushed. I brought you the stories, letters between the White House and the Teachers Federation, the American Federation of Teachers, which is the largest teacher union in America. By the way, Terry Weingarten is the head of that union. She makes $500,000 a year, folks. Spends over $1.6 million a year on luxury hotels and travel amenities, and spends another $44 million of her dues-paying members' money in political spending, and 100% of it goes to the Democratic Party. She's also, by the way, but you know, she's unbiased. She really cares about your kids. She's also a member of the Democratic National Committee and an ardent and open supporter of the far left, the far, far left movement in America. Now, let's kind of, this is all tied in. So we have the Justice Department creating this special task force. We have Inslee up there in Washington in the last week coming up with his can't question an election or you go to jail and lose your public office. Now we have the DHS. You know, this is the same department, Mayorkas, I've told you about this guy. I told you about him before he was appointed. That's allowing, give or take, 2 million illegal aliens with no vetting, very little ID, no testing, no jabs, no nothing, to come across our border, feast on the American taxpayers' dollar, and be shipped off in the night by bus and plane to unknown destinations that are kept secret from the communities that they're landing in, or shall I say, being strategically placed in, and the states that are then going to have to provide for them. Okay, the same. This is the same DHS. So the DHS. Let me just read you a little thing from what they put out this week. This is without any law, any legislation, any vote by the House, any vote by the Senate, any vote by a state. You know, it's that fluid constitution notion of the last week from President Cadaver. Quote, the United States remains in a heightened threat environment fueled by several factors, including an online environment filled with false or misleading narratives and conspiracy theories, and other forms of mis, dis, and malinformation, which they label, by the way, MDM. Ooh, yes, we have an acronym. introduced and or amplified by foreign and domestic threat actors. These threat actors seek to exacerbate societal friction to sow discord and undermine public trust in government institutions to encourage unrest, which could potentially inspire acts of violence. Do you remember the Supreme Court decisions on censorship that I just told you about? Okay, listen to this wording. Mass casualty attacks and other acts of targeted violence conducted by lone offenders and small groups acting in furtherance of ideological beliefs and or personal grievances pose an ongoing threat to the nation. By the way, they don't mention Black Lives Matter or Antifa in here, of course. While the conditions underlying the heightened threat landscape have not significantly changed over the last year, the convergence of the following factors has increased the volatility, unpredictability, and complexity of the threat environment. Number one, the proliferation of false or misleading narratives, which sow discord or undermine public trust in U.S. government institutions. Number two, continued calls for violence directed at U.S. critical infrastructure. I mean, I'm on the news, folks. I haven't heard of that one yet, but that's okay. They can make it up. Soft targets and mass gatherings. Faith-based institutions such as churches, synagogues, and mosques. Institutions of higher education. Racial and religious minorities. Well, you know, it wouldn't be complete here without some racial stuff going on. Government facilities and personnel, including law enforcement. Now, I'm going to stop right here for a moment. This is the defund the police crowd. Suddenly concerned about the facilities and personnel, including law enforcement. You know, like taking over police stations in Washington, you know, Inslee State, and in Oregon, and burning federal courthouses to the ground. You mean those guys? Oh, yeah, okay. Oh, wow. Including law enforcement and the military, the media, the perceived ideological opponents. And number three, calls by foreign terrorist organizations for attacks on the United States based on recent events. In other words, folks, let me boil this down to you. Not only if you question the government, or if you mention, if you whisper that you don't trust the government, or you don't trust certain actions of the government, not only are you a domestic terrorist who could, you know, do all these terrible things that the left has been doing for the last 5 years, but you are the reason there's foreign terrorism. You got this? You don't want to miss all the nuances in here. By the way, further down in their threat warning, the DHS adds on their information. Why don't we call it their disinformation? You know, you can always count on the left doing what it's accusing you of doing, okay? You can always count on it. I mean, 100% of the time. Let me read this to you. Number one, the proliferation of false or misleading narratives which sow discord or undermine public trust in U.S. government institutions. For example, there is widespread online proliferations of false misleading narratives, blah, 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 blah. Malignant foreign powers have and continue to amplify these false or misleading narratives in efforts to damage the United States. So, let me boil this down for you. Washington, the state of Washington, and Washington, D.C., the country. Any talk of a stolen election, folks, is causing terrorism. These are the folks who made up the lie that Trump was Putin's puppet. Absolutely black and white, proven now. Durham, Mueller, I can go all the way down the list. But we are the cause of unrest and division. Just want to make sure. And anybody who even asks a question is a domestic terrorist. Let me tell you another one that ties right in with this. So in this last week, there's a county clerk by the name of Peters up in Mesa County, Colorado, which is a conservative county. Grand Junction is kind of the county seat. I'm very familiar with it. And the Secretary of State, Jenna, J-E-N-A, is a Soros puppet. She was put into office with Soros money. I think we all have a pretty good feel by now of George Soros and what his goals are and what his animosities toward the Constitution, you, individual rights, sovereign nations as opposed to globalism, etc., is. Well, Secretary of State Gina, she ordered all her county clerks to destroy. This is illegal, folks. You have to keep these records for 7 years by law. She ordered all her county clerks in all the counties of Colorado to destroy the 2020 election results, particularly in the Dominion machines. Why would you do that? I mean, since you had such a free and fair election and nobody can question it, why would you want to destroy what the machines have in them? We'll have to think about that one. Well, Peters, who's a staunch conservative, by the way, said, okay, I'll destroy it, but I'm going to keep a copy. Well, Peters got arrested for really keeping the copy, but on some other trumped-up charge, more or less on direct orders from the State House in Denver this past week. It's going to be an interesting brouhaha up there in Mesa County. And I think, once again, it's going to backfire on the left because what's really going on is going to come out in the course of the trial. Then, we're not done. It's like a bad infomercial. It goes on and on and on and on. So the Democrats are desperate about 2022. This is why you're seeing all this nonsense, these the mask Gestapo suddenly reverse course and say there's new science, no more masks, we're all free, we're all done, America is back. And why you're seeing all this nonsense from the DHS and up in Washington State from Inslee and over in New York State. They have a new game plan now. Oh, and all the battles going on in all the states over redistricting, which, by the way, can hurt the Republicans because the Republicans, unfortunately, sat on their butts. They didn't aggressively try and expand their districts. They just protected the districts they had. And the Democrats are trying to expand the number of districts. Look, I went over this last week. This is a multifaceted battle raging on many planes. It is a three-dimensional political chess game. And the new piece on the board is, you probably heard of Madison Cawthorn, right? He's this paraplegic Republican from North Carolina. You've probably heard something on the news over the past month or two about how there's a group trying to say that he can't run. Let me tell you what this is all based on, because you're going to see it pop up on other things. And it's tied into J6. You know, the J6 committee sending subpoenas to Jordan and sending subpoenas to other Republican lawmakers who basically told him to go pound sand. This is all about this new tactic of the Democratic Marxists, which is to use the 14th Amendment to the U.S. Constitution, which, by the way, was ratified to prevent former Confederate supporters from running for federal union offices, to prevent modern-day Republicans from running or holding offices or seats. In 1872, little history lesson here, Congress also passed the Amnesty Act, which removed the disqualification from Confederates and their sympathizers in terms of running and holding federal office. The 14th Amendment was passed, you know, that was the issues of that day. The 14th Amendment, nevertheless, folks, you can't play both sides of the fence here like the left does. It exists. And the questions as to how it might relate to the January 6th riot on Capitol Hill is once again in the form of who gets censored and who subjectively determines what certain things are. In other words, what's the meaning of words? What's the definition of is, according to Bill Clinton? There's no evidence in the case down there against Madison Cawthorn that he had anything to do with J6, other than he gave a speech which promoted peaceful gathering that day. He wasn't up on the Capitol. He certainly didn't exhort anybody to violence. But Democrats are trying to stop him because he's immensely popular from running for re-election based on the 14th Amendment. And of course, if they're successful, this is kind of like a trial balloon, they'll use it against Donald Trump, which is really what the J6 committee is all about, not to mention some political fodder in a barren landscape of political fodder for the Democrats this year. The 14th Amendment is seldom used, unfortunately, for a good reason. The disqualification clause in the 14th Amendment, it covers any person who has taken an oath to uphold the U.S. Constitution and otherwise engages in, listen to the word, insurrection or rebellion against the United States, or gives aid or comfort to the enemies of the United States. So now we come down to, was J6 an insurrection or a riot? Oh, the definition of terms again. And how do you decide on the definition of terms? Well, you have dialogue. And how do you have dialogue? Well, you don't have dialogue if you are censored. It all ties in. This is a concerted effort by the left across the board. Okay, Democrats have labeled, the J6 committee has labeled January 6th as an insurrection for over a year. great constitutional law professor, Jonathan Turley, I'm sure you folks are familiar with him, says it is not an insurrection. It was a day of reckless rhetoric, and it became a riot. The insurrection label, though, isn't about law, folks. It's about politics. Although insurrection is a legal term, it is impossible, if not virtually impossible, to invoke an insurrection after the fact of an insurrection. The Constitution allows Congress to call the militia, which is the National Guard, by the way, to suppress an insurrection. Trump offered 20,000 National Guardsmen. House Speaker Pelosi rejected the Guard's presence, both before and during the riot, I might add. Congress can pass, I mean, they're allowed under the Constitution and the 14th Amendment, they can pass legislation to declare an act of civil disobedience an insurrection. That's Section 5 of the 14th Amendment. Yet Congress hasn't done so. Why is that? Well, maybe because not every Democrat agrees it was a legally defined insurrection, and obviously no Republicans, maybe except Mitch McConnell and our great gal here, Liz Cheney from Wyoming, they're going to support such a measure. They're not going to do it. And the Supreme Court has ruled that it's up to the president to determine if a civil disturbance, as it happens, rises to the level of an insurrection. Well, none of that has happened. I mean, them's the facts, Jack. So January 6th is an insurrection, but they are going to use, through the J6 committee, anybody and everything and whatever they can to try and tie Republicans to J6 and then say they can't run for office, i.e. Madison Cawthorn. By the way, as an interesting sidelight, CBS did a poll on this just a week ago, and Americans disagree with Democrats. In fact, 76% of the people polled believe J6 were the protests that went too far, but not an insurrection. And that, folks, includes a large number of Democratic voters. So good luck on that, Nancy and crew. We were talking about George Soros, because all these things that the Democratic Marxists are doing requires money, requires push, requires lift. And obviously they're getting much money from the globalists. They're getting much money from the wealthy, super elite, arch leftists here in America, like, you know, the Hollywood crowd. So all that money's flowing in. But once again, it is George Soros who is really the wellspring of dark money. And not only is he using it to get Secretary of States like Gina in Colorado elected, but as we've discussed, he is heavily invested in local races for prosecutors and getting progressives in who advocate, you know, criminal justice reform. There was a report that was put out by Joel Pollack here in the last few weeks. So Soros supported prosecutors across the United States has exactly correlated with the numbers and the locations in a huge surge of crime and murders, all in Democratic-run cities, of course. Gee, imagine that. And this involves policing, sentencing, incarceration. I mean, basically, he's using his money to make cities more dangerous. I wonder if the DHS is going to do anything about George Soros making things more dangerous for all of us. You know, inciting violence. Pollack in Los Angeles, the district attorney there. George Gascon. These people, these DAs, have presided over increases in murders and crime ranging from 40 to 70% depending upon the crime. In fact, LA saw a 53.9% increase in murders since 2019. And by the way, this book that this gentleman did, Joel Pollack, it has a complete list of prosecutors who have been elected with the support of George Soros. You got to see if your local prosecutor is in there and you need to, you know, they need to go away. You need to get somebody in there who believes in law, order, and the Constitution. Some of the other people that Soros has gotten in, okay, Cook County State's Attorney Kim Fox, you know, in Chicago. Remember, you know, the Smollett deal? Philadelphia's District Attorney Larry Krasner, oh, up to his neck in election fraud in 2020. Houston's Harris County District Attorney Kim Ogg, another, you know, whatever. Dallas County District Attorney John Cruzat, and many more. I mean, folks, if you want law and order, you better get people into office who believe in law and order and who are going to diligently prosecute the laws. equally, you know, equal opportunity law enforcement. The latest big addition in a major city, you know, Soros started this off like in counties and towns, and he had such success, he's now going for the big cities. So District Attorney Alvin Bragg, okay, he was elected because of the support of Color of Change PAC, who just happened to receive $1 million, this is for district attorney race, folks, from Soros. Bragg, immediately upon taking office in New York, this is just a couple months ago, he announced he's going to end incarceration and sentencing for a variety of crimes in New York. So all pretrial incarceration, doesn't matter almost what the crime is, except homicide and a handful of others, means the perp, or the alleged perp, is walking free. It's terrific. Speaking of law and order, interesting little story here. So there's been a bunch of riots. I don't know if you know this or not, because mainstream media isn't covering it, in cities in Minnesota, particularly Minneapolis, over the last several weeks. I mean, it's like a replay of the summer before last. And this comes from a gentleman getting shot by police, and his name was Winston. Okay, he was 32 years old, and the Black Lives Matter crowd has gone berserk, and they've kind of picked up his trumpet, so to speak. And, you know, he was just this really nice guy who was unarmed and, you know, the usual nonsense story. Let me just tell you that Winston, if you've even heard of this, given the media blackout around it, you know, censorship, Winston was really not a really nice guy. In fact, 7 weeks before he was shot, on his Instagram, and by the way, he was a rapper, he talked about how protesters were doing all wrong with their hands in the air. And he suggested that he'll be bringing guns. He'll be bringing the same weapons, this is a quote, the police have to the next protest. Let me quote. Asking for justice? Seriously, that's the plan? MFs? Been killing you all for years. Hey, I ride with this crap for years. When it comes to me, that's not the plan, y'all. I'm coming to the protest. I'm bringing the same blank they bringing. We got guns and bulletproof vests, too, or should be able to get them. Why not just rush these effers and start this war they keep asking for? This is the guy that's... His death has now sparked riots in Minneapolis. Okay, terrific. I wonder if he was covered on that DHS memo that I told you about here in the rat-a-tat-tat. Yeah, you bet. I don't have an update for you on this massive race between China and the United States to recover an F-35 aircraft that went off a flight carrier deck in the South China Sea. I brought you that story about a week ago. China was kind of winning at that point. We shall see. The F-35 falling into China's hands would not be a good thing. I'll keep you apprised. Kind of a good thing, although in a way it's kind of reverse censorship. But think about it. There's a Florida House committee. They've passed a bill that would forbid discussions about gender ideology and sexual orientation, at least in primary level classrooms. This is a week ago, Thursday. That's the House Education Employment Committee, by the way, in Florida. And the name of the bill is Parental Rights in Education Bill. It's also known as the Don't Say Gay. And it bans teachers from discussing LGBTQ issues or similar matters with elementary school students. I mean, I think that's probably appropriate. Think about the cases I gave you from the Supreme Court and other federal courts that has to do with obscenity, minors, decency, etc. They're probably on firm land there legally. And the legislation also allows parents to pursue declaratory or injunctive relief, basically a TRO, against the school district if these new rules are violated. And it also requires school administrators to notify parents if a student's mental, emotional, physical health, well-being, whatever, begins to change, which right now they don't have to do. So kind of a good thing for the parents down there, and I think properly limited to elementary school. You know, kids that are 13 and above, kind of a different program, but nonetheless requires constant monitoring and supervision so that facts are being portrayed on a level playing field. Little kids who are, you know, 7, 8 years old, I mean, they just simply believe what the teacher tells them, which is, of course, the whole shtick of the left. That right? You may not have known this, but did you know that Washington, D.C. has actually gone on food rationing on a number of food products? Do you remember over the last 3-4 months I've been warning you that the shortages that you were beginning to see and the higher prices that you were beginning to see are in fact going to worsen. And I urge you to get prepared. I hope you did, or I hope you're in the process of. And if you did not, I sincerely hope you begin promptly. Washington, D.C., the nation's cap, is now rationing certain types of food. And that was before the Canadian truckers deal. That was before the border was more or less closed by ridiculous vaccination mandates, and then a week or two later by the truckers themselves. And that is before this, what should be a massive convoy, starts descending on Washington, D.C., beginning on the west coast of the United States. Trucks that are involved in these protests, and I'm all for it. You know, if I don't get my green beans because they're doing their thing, then I'll just go without the green beans. When these trucks are on the road and they're tied up in these protests, they're not delivering goods, folks. You know, keep all this in mind. There's a lot of things that are coming to a boil right now. And a lot of them affect a supply chain which was already, not mortally, but severely injured, we'll call it. I'm not even going to have time to finish the rat-a-tat-a-tat-a-tat-a-tat today. It's unbelievable. And I'm not going to have time to get into the COVID matters, the hospital reimbursements, should we say coercion and bribes by the federal government to mistreat you and to not treat you. I will tell you that we've done a lot of research on it. We're also researching, based on a number of rumors we have heard, I talked to you a little bit about it last week, on various batches of this vaccine, some of them almost placebo, some of them kind of neutral, you know, a normal dose, and some of them kind of killer jabs, and the potential of the distribution of those various batches to various areas of the country, like, you know, bad batches to red states and placebos to blue states. We're actually doing research. I don't know if this is true or not. We do know that batches have been returned by other countries because there was something wrong with them. I gave you several examples, like Japan. So obviously some batches somewhere have been detected to be bad. Now, whether that was intentional, whether it was a manufacturing error, whether or not they're continuing to be made and they're being targeted and deliberately distributed, I don't know. I would hope not. But I actually have my producers doing research right now on the all-cause mortality and adverse effects from VAERS through the VAERS site in red states versus blue states. And I will share that with you next week, one way or the other. I mean, maybe it's all innocent, maybe it's not so innocent at all. I don't know. And next week, I'm going to go over this hospital stuff with the specific amounts for various treatments. One of the things I've uncovered is that it's not just an admission to a hospital or the testing that you get paid for or paid bonuses for in certain events if you're a hospital. They actually have broken down the testing into different increments that you get paid for or different types of tests. And the same with a number of the other medical procedures. I mean, it's unbelievable. When you look at this, you begin to understand why in certain states, which, by the way, happen to be red states, which I find interesting, Nebraska, $379,000 per COVID patient average, West Virginia, $471,000, North Dakota, $339,000. That's a lot of money, folks. Next week, I'll break it down for you more specifically. Many of you have asked on exactly what a hospital gets paid for what during the entire stage from the time you walk in the door to the time you hopefully leave or carried out in a body bag, how they get paid every step of the way, in some cases, bonuses. It's unbelievable. In the meantime, I want you all to have a great week. I think we have some new stations coming our way, which I'll announce next week. Thank you so much for listening to The Right Side Radio. And remember, I will muster, I will stand, I will not comply. This is Reed Lance Rosenthal on The Right Side Radio.
Please remember, if you've missed any shows, just click on Show Archive and you'll find all of his shows. We look forward to seeing you here again next week for another episode of Reed Lance Rosenthal on The Right Side.